This is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeras, New Mexico, and this is our special podcast series, Colorblind. I'm speaking via phone with Karlsruhe alum Mark Greer. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Circe, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I wanted to tell our listeners that we are, like I said, in phone because you're on the East Coast and we are in a pandemic, and I wanted to take the time to thank you for being here. Let's just jump right in. Since you went to Karlsruhe, I'm assuming you're an Army brat.
I am. As of Monday, I'm a 56-year-old Army brat.
Oh, well, happy birthday. did you graduate Karlsruhe? I know you went to Karlsruhe, but did you graduate?
No, I left Karlsruhe my sophomore year. I graduated high school from 71st High School in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
So you left Karlsruhe and you moved to North Carolina. Where else was your family stationed?
Outside of Karlsruhe, we were stationed in Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And my dad retired at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Okay, so where was your favorite post of all of those?
Karlsruhe.
So why is that? Well, let me finish. And then what was your least favorite?
My least favorite, none really, because when we were at Fort Campbell, I was probably 3 years old,
uh-huh.
So I don't remember that much. The only places I remember vividly are Karlsruhe and Fort Bragg, because that's where I grew up.
Okay. So I know that you said Karlsruhe was your favorite post. And you mentioned it a lot on Facebook. We're Facebook friends, but like I haven't met half my Facebook friends, so I know you're always talking about it. What made Karlsruhe so special for you?
At the time, unbeknownst to me, it opened my eyes to a lot of things that since I've gotten older, have become even more important. I didn't realize it at the time. Like a lot of kids, I was 12 when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really want to be there because I left all of my friends in the States.
Right.
But by the time it was time for my dad to leave, I didn't want to leave Karlsruhe. Because like a lot of military brats, you make friends and then all of a sudden it's a 3 or 4 year period and you go make different friends. But this was different. I think the biggest thing for me is that Karlsruhe came at the right time of my life when my view of the world was being formed. And for me, there was no better place to be than in an environment when I was allowed to be a kid and learn to appreciate people just as people. You know, it's cliche-ish to say that we live, you know, we lived in a colorblind society, but no one, as far as I knew, saw anyone based on the color of their skin. It was the person. You know, people saw me as Mark. I saw them as Sue or Tony or Mike. And we were just allowed to just be. And it was probably the most beautiful thing up to that point in my life that I had experienced. Because when I got back to the States, like a lot of us have mentioned on the page, it was kind of a culture shock.
Well, let's just jump right into that, because I lived in Karlsruhe from 67 to 79, so from kindergarten through graduation. I couldn't wait to leave Karlsruhe. I wanted to grow up and move on, and when I finally left Germany, you know, after like, what, 12, 14 years, whatever it was, I had a culture shock. And so I wanted to talk to you. What do you mean? When you graduated high school and went back to the States and went to college, where did you end up and how was it a culture shock?
When I got back, a lot of the friends that I had when I left, you know, there was a 3-year gap. So it wasn't as easy as, hey, he's back, let's pick up where we left off. It was a disconnect. And a lot of the things that I saw and experienced were a 180 from Karlsruhe. When you think, hey, when I come to the States, it's going to be just like it was in Karlsruhe, it wasn't. The race thing was still there, which shocked me. was obvious to me early on that I didn't fit. From the standpoint, I think, as a 15-year-old living in a foreign country, I was a little bit more mature, probably a little better grounded, and I think had a greater appreciation for true friendship. When I got back, it was, you know, some things reared their head. As an example, although we didn't see color in Karlsruhe, it wasn't abnormal to see people of different colors dating each other.
Right.
And one instance, there was a young man, it was a black guy dating a white girl at school, and I remember guys giving him a difficult time and giving her a difficult time. And it boggled my mind because it didn't make sense to me as to why. And I remember his name was Robert. I used to talk to him. And I told him, I said, you know, if you ever need my help, let me know. Just because I just thought it was wrong. And it was foreign to me. And so as, you know, you see more of those things, I didn't feel the connection. I didn't see the togetherness as I experienced in Karlsruhe. So I kind of kept to myself. And it just, I won't say it was difficult because I played sports, but it was, I never found that closeness, if you will, or that genuine friendship where you would look at someone and know beyond a shadow of a doubt, that's my friend.
So was the school you ended up graduating from in North Carolina, that wasn't a Dodd school or a school on post, was it? It was off post?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. Because, you know, part of, you know, a lot of military brats talk about color blindness, and also, you know, the military, just being in the military milieu, made Karlsruhe happen, whereas maybe a stateside school, you know, with multiracial dating or you know, a disconnect. So you moved back to North Carolina. You felt kind of, you know, out of touch with what had happened while you were gone. Did you go to college then in North Carolina, or did you go somewhere else?
No, I went in North Carolina. I went to Fayetteville State University, which was in my hometown, and it's an HBCU. So the student population there was probably at that time 99% black, and it was a small school. But ironically, being such a small school, I developed friendships there that are still strong to this day. And I equate that to similar to being Karlsruhe because there were people from different areas.
Right.
Different states, different cities who were coming together at a school similar to Karlsruhe. We all were from different states, but we all gathered in Karlsruhe, so you formed a bond. So from that standpoint, you know, I experienced a little bit of Karlsruhe when I got to college. Not much. I still kind of kept to myself. I kept my circle of friends small. Because then, you know, you're in college, you're exposed to some different things which you hadn't seen before.
Right.
And so when you see some of those things, I didn't particularly indulge in them. So, you know, I kept to myself a little bit more in college, too.
So you mentioned, for our listeners, I wanted to clarify HBCU, Historic Black College?
Yes.
Okay. So what career path did you take when you graduated? What did you study, and what was your goal in that?
I studied economics, and my goal at the time was to go to New York, become a stockbroker, stay 10 years, come back to North Carolina, open up my own brokerage firm. The ultimate goal was to get people who were struggling economically to see what they could do if they pooled their money. That was the goal. Well, life happens.
Right.
Some things happen. My parents divorced. And, you know, I had a younger sister. My brother was getting ready to go to college when I graduated. So we had to put all of that on hold, get to help mom pay the bills and do all of that. So, you know, that kind of fell by the wayside. Then I got into manufacturing for a number of years, management there. Laid off from a job in, oh, I guess 1999. The stars lined up, and in a strange way, I wound up working with people who had disabilities. Don't know how I got there, but it was one of the greatest things that happened to me, because like Carl's Drew, it got me to appreciate people for people. And so you take on the task of getting people to realize disability doesn't mean inability. Most importantly, the individuals themselves. And to see the light go on in their eyes and realize there's some things that they can do when you may be the only one telling them that they can. It was a beautiful thing. So indirectly, that led me to doing some speaking. I do some career advising now too. So it's more of a, I work directly with people, whether speaking to them or whether it's helping them to plan out a career path.
So you're like a life coach.
Life coach, counselor, psychiatrist, confidant, whatever it needs to be for that individual. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Do you help with, when you're working with people with disabilities, are you helping them, you know, with finances because you have the economics background, or is it something different?
It was helping them with jobs, helping them become advocates for themselves. I've always had this thing of the underdog or people who were considered to be less than, somehow wanting to help them or take up for them. And in this case, when you see someone that society says has a disability or it's different, you know, I used to pose the question, who really has the disability? You know, because you're saying because they're not like me, they're different. Well, who's to say that you're 100% okay yourself? And so it became more of a, how can I get through to these people to get them to realize that they have value, that there are some things that they can do? Again, that disability doesn't mean inability. And so just, you know, if we all are honest with ourselves, there's something wrong with all of us.
Well, it sounds like you found your true calling. Based on, you know, what you post on Facebook and what you've just described, it sounds like a wonderful match for you. And I wanted to tell, and I wanted to explain to our listeners, so I follow you on Facebook, and you're frequently posting these video blogs commenting on all sorts of topics ranging from nostalgia to current events. It's always uplifting and thought-provoking. And it's kind of funny because you're sitting in your car doing it. So I know you've got this match made in heaven with your job and your speaking and your personality and all that. But I wanted to know. I know you, and you have people who follow you and like you, and they're commenting. So why do you make these little video blog things? Why do you put your thoughts and yourself out on social media like that?
There's more words are fine, but sometimes to get the full effect, you need to see and hear from the person directly. And it's just something different. It didn't happen on purpose. It was just one day I decided to give it a try and see what would happen. And then now it becomes more of a, if the message really hits me or something that I really want to say, it's easy to type it in, but, you know, sometimes you have to have the personal effect. And so it's a matter of, and you mentioned the key phrase, thought-provoking. And a lot of them, that's the goal, is to get people to think. Because if we can get people to think, see, then better things come. A lot of people react.
Right.
But I'm trying to get people to respond, because in a response, you have to think. And so if we can get people to thinking, now all of a sudden, we open up the gateways to progress, because people are using their minds and not their emotions.
Right, and I noticed that you're the people that follow you, and when you engage in the comments and the questions, nobody is over-talking each other, you know? And I think listening and thinking is important. Well, and so speaking of talking, you know, with everything going on, and we're probably going to hit this several times, but with everything going on right now and people are in their homes, I am sure there are some very intense conversations going on about all sorts of current events, like the economy, like the public outrage about, you know, the police brutality and George Floyd and all of that. And so thinking about these kitchen table conversations and then reflecting back on your own childhood, because you grew up in the, you know, in the 70s and 80s, what kind of conversations did your family, your folks have with you when you were growing up?
We didn't have the talk like some people are saying now about how to act if you're around the police. I will give you one example that has stuck with me all of these years, and I remember it like it was yesterday. I was 5 years old. We were at a fair at Fort Bragg Fairgrounds, and to this day I don't know what happened, but I remember the reaction of my father. And I was playing a game, and something happened. The guy running the game did something, but I remember it set my father off. And I had never seen him react that fast and that way. And my mother was trying to calm him down, and the very thing that he said was, no, he's trying to take advantage of him because he's black. I remember that vividly like it happened yesterday. And at the age of five, it had an impact on me. From the standpoint, it could have gone one or two ways. It could have gone, well, people are going to take advantage of you, but it went the opposite way. And I realized, in seeing my father react that way, the seed was planted in me to never let anyone take advantage of you because of the color of your skin. And so that seed of strength, if you will, was embedded in me then. And so it was, I was fortunate that where my parents are from in Tennessee, I always talked to a lot of older people. So I was able to hear from people who experienced things firsthand.
Right.
And to this day, I'm an eyes person. I will talk to someone, but I will look at their eyes. And these older people, when they would talk to me as a child, I could see in their eyes them reliving certain experiences. And they would cry and get emotional. And it fascinated me that as they're telling me these stories as a young boy, it still had an impact on them that was so powerful it still moved them. And so I grew up asking questions and learning more and seeing more and getting firsthand. And it became more of a somehow, some way, we've got to get people together. Because if we don't, you know, then we're all going to die anyway in a very bad way. From a standpoint of intellect, from a standpoint of morality, from a standpoint of the soul. And so the only conversations my parents really had with me was that you respect everybody and you demand respect from everybody. And so I give everybody respect. You know, I talk to them and treat them as a child of God. And as long as I'm doing that, I'm okay. If someone decides to come a different way, then we correct them then and there. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you know, my whole purpose is to, whenever I can, you know, we try to unite. Mm-hmm. We try to get people to understand, to see the other side of the fence. Mm-hmm. So that they too can go, okay, I see where you're coming from. We may not agree, but I get your point.
Well, you know, that's so hard when you see on the social media. Well, fast forwarding to now, you know, we're in this pandemic, and even within the pandemic, there are so many divisions and sides, you know. And then, in addition to the pandemic, there's all of this other stuff happening. People have lost their jobs, and there's the police brutality and politics and removing symbols of, like, they're thinking about renaming Fort Bragg because it was named for a Confederate soldier. There's huge discussions of racism and there's no easy answers or fixes, and many people aren't talking civilly. What are you experiencing in North Carolina about all of that? Okay, pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests and the talk about renaming Fort Bragg and removing Confederate statues. What do you see down there?
Well, I just saw a report today about discussions about changing the name of Fort Bragg. I don't think that's going to happen because Fort Bragg's been around too long. Mm-hmm. I just saw a news report where NASCAR is no longer allowing the Confederate flag to be flown at their events. Mm-hmm. All of this, you know, okay, it's conversations. It's all reactionary. Mm-hmm. The death of George Floyd, and I've said this before, is different because protests went worldwide, but it was just the match on the gasoline, if you will. Mm-hmm. This has been coming for quite some time. Mm-hmm. This time, however, here in North Carolina, actually, there have been several protests. At the beginning, some got out of hand. Mm-hmm. I don't say those were protesters, those were agitators, people who came in to do what they were going to do anyway, mm-hmm. where there's bus window steal. They just took advantage of an opportunity. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, once it kind of settled down and people started listening and really having a purpose, my own personal opinion, especially at the beginning, a lot of people go out because it's fashionable. Mm-hmm. And it became nice to say Black Lives Matter and all of that. I've always responded, you know, when did Black Lives not matter? My life matters to me. But, you know, things become, better statement, we pick slogans. Uh-huh. And people will take a slogan and they'll run with it. And the protesting is for a purpose, is nice. I went home this past weekend, and they had a memorial for George Floyd in Rayford. Mm-hmm. And I had never seen so many people and so many state troopers. But it gave me solace because I saw people of all different races. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, people get it. Mm-hmm. We can't continue to go on this way. In a span of 3 months, we've seen Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, you know, George Floyd. Mm-hmm. It can't continue this way because something will give. But here we are, and the question is, now what? Like I said earlier, George Floyd's been laid to rest. He's no longer here. Now what? Because there has to be something. What is going to change? What are we going to get out of this? And when I say we, I mean we as a community, we as a nation. What is going to come from this? Because there are only two options. We're going to be bitter or we're going to be better. So my take is there needs to be some serious discussion about becoming better. Whatever that may be, however that may come about, whatever laws need to be changed, there has to be a discussion and a commitment to becoming better. We've been down this road too many times, and we can't continue that way.
So I was struck by your words, and I listened to the funeral service yesterday, and I didn't see it, but I heard it on the radio, and there were so many parents whose children had been killed there at that, and that was a very eye-opening moment, a very sad moment. As a parent, I cannot imagine. And I was wondering, you know, you say we need to talk, how can we be better? Who do we need at the table to have civil conversations to work towards resolving these complicated issues? And can it be resolved?
It can be resolved. I have always believed this. When it comes to race and touchy subjects, historically, the people who have been involved in these conversations, that's in the media, mm-hmm. aren't necessarily the people who probably need to be sitting at the table.
Right.
My own personal belief is that when you have intelligent people, and I'm not going to say on both sides because I don't believe in that side thing, mm-hmm. but when you have intelligent people who can sit down and really go, okay, what can we do collectively? It's not a matter of what are black people going to do? Mm. What are white people going to do? What are Asians or Hispanics going to do? Mm. So what are we going to do collectively?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It will take a group of everybody sitting down and addressing the issue. Okay, we have an issue. We know what the issue is. We don't need to rehash it, but right now we need to focus on what are the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And then go about making those solutions reality. There's a lot of talk, and people will say things and they sound nice, and we're going to do this and we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it stays.
Mm-hmm.
I use this quote all the time. Frederick Douglass said, you know, power can cease nothing without a demand.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, when someone has been killed and injustice is done, it lasts for a moment. And people will march and they'll protest and they come up with these slogans, but they're not demanding anything. The civil rights movement, the reason it was so powerful, people marched, but they were marching to get something.
Right.
They marched to get voting rights. They marched to get civil rights. Mm-hmm. And I said a long time ago, even the right to sit wherever they wanted to sit on a bus,
mm-hmm.
there was something tangible that was to be gained from protesting. So this go around, what is that something tangible going to be? Again, we keep going down this road for a reason. Maybe someone's given us the opportunity again to try to get it right, or maybe it's like Einstein says, you know, I'm paraphrasing, history doesn't repeat itself, stupid people repeat history.
Right. So what we need...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking that, so what you're saying is we have to actually be able to define what it is that we want. As a collective, and maybe get to the root cause of what is the problem?
Yes. Yes, it's... If you have a garden...
Mm-hmm.
And you planted all these beautiful roses, but these weeds keep popping up. You can take some scissors and you can prune the weeds and pull the weeds, but if you don't get the root, the weeds come back.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't get to the root cause and deal with the root cause of the issue, mm-hmm. the weeds keep coming back. And then we wonder why the garden can't be cleared out. Because we don't deal with the root. It is difficult. It is uncomfortable. But it's necessary. It for if this was done the right way, if people were really committed to do it, it's going to force people to have difficult conversations. It may lead to some temporary adversity. But I've always believed this. On the other side of every adversity is a miracle. If we're committed to getting to the other side.
Well, it sounds like you've, you know, given this a lot of thought, and I really do hope that we can get the right people having a conversation. I think every conversation that one has that isn't yelling or talking over is the start. So I wanted to follow up. I don't know if you want to define the issues or if you want to leave it for each community to figure out what the issue is in their community. But I don't know if you had anything more to say on that.
I'll give you a friend of mine's son works at a grocery store. This happened about a week ago. And he was scanning this couple's groceries. And the guy looked at him. He's 17 years old and asked him, "Why aren't you out protesting like the rest of your kind?" And Omar said, "Sir," and the guy looked at him again and said, "You know, I went and bought some extra ammo for your kind." Now the kid is 17. And so I text his mother and asked her to give him a message from me. And the message was simple, because she said that he had cried. And I told him that the tears he shed weren't from weakness, weren't from sorrow. The tears he shed were the spirits of his ancestors letting him know that there is still work to be done, and he is equipped intellectually with everything that he needs to take this to the next level. To be the solution, to find a way, and let his tears now that he shed become tears of determination tomorrow to make a better way. If we don't get it together in supposedly the greatest country on earth, if we don't get it together, the freedoms in which we talk about, the opportunities that are supposedly here, if we don't get it together, we're no better than a lot of the third world countries sometimes that people chastise. I'm not one to, I mean, I don't have all the answers. I'm not one that's going to point fingers and say, it's your fault or it's my fault. It doesn't really matter, because the issue is here. The focus needs to be on the solution. And I'm just a firm believer, you know, I hate on the media when they say people of color.
Why?
Because you automatically draw the line. You say people of color, and I guess you're inferring people who are not of color. And I've always followed up with, okay, what color are you talking about? And so when the dialogue is divisive from the beginning, you won't find any common ground, because people are coming from a standpoint of friction. But if we go, I agree there's an issue and it shouldn't be happening, how do we resolve it? The focus has got to be on the solution. Now the commitment, that's another question. But it's going to take everybody, from the local communities to local governments, state governments, even the federal government, everybody coming together on one accord, going, you know, it's time that we need to live up to the creed, what's in the Declaration of Independence. If all men and women are created equal, then we can't just talk about it. We have to be about it. And if we're not going to be about it, then we need to stop lying. And I don't think anyone wants to do that. So we stand on the truth and we make the truth, you know, reality. If not in this lifetime, for those who come after us. I'm rambling here, but there's certain things in life that I'm passionate about.
Yeah. So my question is, does it feel different this time? Because there have been, you know, there's been discussion about, you know, these kinds of things before. I mean, even in the last couple of years, does it feel different this time? I know you said we're now worldwide protesting, but I think even last time it was, some of it went worldwide. Does it feel different to you? Because I think it feels different to me.
It feels different from the standpoint, this has lasted for several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I hate to say this, out of George Floyd's death, there has come a beautiful sight of seeing people of all races come together,
mm-hmm.
to not only protest, but denounce a wrong,
mm-hmm.
and do it now, peacefully,
mm-hmm.
but to keep it up and to demand some things get done. Now, what I hope doesn't happen is that since we are in an election year, that people don't try to use this as some kind of tool.
Mm.
I would hope that the pressure, whoever runs the government, local, city, state, whatever,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that people will keep it up and say, okay, listen, we have voted you in. The issue still remains.
Right.
What are you going to do? Because this is what we would like to see. It's time to get it done. If we don't let it die, then I think change will come. If people go on to the next story and people forget, then it's just a matter of time before we cross this road again.
Yeah.
I just don't think we can let that happen.
Well, it kind of reminds me of like the shootings that happen in schools. I mean, how many school shootings
yes.
do you have to have? And it seems like it's the same thing over and over, you know. Horrible thing happens, people protest, and then move on. So I guess I'm going to just ask this then. For people who want to be involved in working for change, but they can't or they don't want to hit the streets because, you know, they just can't protest. They, you know, we are in a pandemic. They have health issues or it's not the way they feel they can best help. I know you mentioned voting and a person I interviewed a couple days ago said the same thing. What else can people do who want to be helpful but don't want to be out in the streets? What do you think?
Say it again.
So, you know, people who want to be helpful but don't want to take to the streets for whatever reason, what can they do to help with this?
There is a story. I'm going to make it a shorter story.
Mm.
But it's about a man who wanted to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he went about trying to change the world, and he realized the world wouldn't change. So he said, well, maybe I'll change my country. And he went out to change his country, but then he realized his country, too, would not change.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, maybe I'll change my state. And he went to change his state, and sadly, he realized his state did not want to change either. So he said, well, maybe I'll just change my neighborhood. And he went to the people in his neighborhood and found out they didn't want to change. And as he sat in his living room, he realized that since he couldn't change the world, the country, or his neighborhood, he said, perhaps I'll change myself. And as he changed himself, he was able to be an example to his neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And they too began to change. So to answer your question, for those who would like to get out and protest, I would say look at yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
Be the example of what you want to see. And let people see that change that you want. Let them see that in you. first. Because if they see that in you and they see what's emanating from you, see, now they're open to hearing what you have to say. You don't have to be out in the public. You can do it on the telephone. But start with yourself and ask yourself some serious questions. What change do I want to see?
Mm-hmm.
And do I exemplify that change?
And am I part of the problem?
Yes. Definitely. And sometimes that's a hard conversation to have when you are pointing the finger at yourself.
Wow. See, that's why I wanted to talk to you. You're very thought-provoking. So it seems like you're answering these questions, but I think I want to just revisit them. So today's high school kids, you know, or college graduates, you know, they've been looking forward to graduating high school, graduating college, starting their lives, and they're entering a world with a horrible economy. We're almost, you know, we're in a recession for sure. A disease that's wreaking havoc all over the place, all over the world. You know, nations are suffering greatly, and then a very polarized population. What kind of message of hope do you give to these kids? I mean, you know, they're just entering into horribleness.
They are. And the one thing I will say is, please understand that you are the CEO of YOU. And as difficult as things are right now, and I understand the need to work, if you have to take something temporarily, that's not what you want to do. But a dollar is better than no dollar.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, get yourself into a position where you can do one of two things: fill a need, solve a problem. When I speak to people, whether it's at a company or people individually, I always talk about, what do you have that you could turn into a business? Not saying full-time off the top if you're looking for a job, but if you're working a job, I don't care if it's making tacos at Taco Bell. That's a temporary thing. What skill set do you have that you can bring to the marketplace or bring to the world that could potentially generate some opportunities for you? Things won't turn around overnight, but look at the industries, look at, especially nowadays, anything from a tech standpoint. The younger people are much more adept at this tech world than I am.
Mm.
It is always evolving. Same thing. If you can fill a need, solve a problem, you're going to be okay. But, you know, look inside yourself first. If it's difficult out there, and it is, you know, what skill set do you have that could potentially generate some income for you? And that sounds kind of vague, but you know, I'm not an advocate of, you know, you finish school, you take a job at Walmart making $7.50 an hour. That's hard to come back from.
Mm-hmm.
So as difficult as it may be, you know, and you're getting frustrated, ask yourself one simple question. I'm being told no by all these companies I go to. Do I have the wherewithal not to take that personally? And when they tell me no, I must say next. Because my job is to keep it moving. And when you get frustrated and you're wanting to give up, you look into the mirror and ask that person looking back at you one question. I know this is a struggle, but am I worth it? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is yes, then you get back up and you keep going. Because as many times as you hear no, it's getting you that much closer to a yes. I will give you a perfect example. 2010, I was laid off from a job. Timing wasn't great. And I said to myself, someone is going to pay me to speak. Did not know who, but that was the goal. I called 156 people. just went online looking up organizations, mm-hmm. anybody that had a position that I thought could get me in somewhere. I called 156 people. The first person I called hung up on me. And that is a no-no in my book. And I got my name out. This is what I do. They went click. And so I could have said, man, forget this. I'm not calling these people. I'm not being told no. But I called the next person, the next organization. And what I found out was as I went through, the pitch got better. It's not, this is who I am. This is what I do. Mm-hmm. It was, this is who I am, this is what I do, and this is how it can benefit you. Mm-hmm. Make a long story short, the 156 person that I called remembered me from a Toastmasters meeting and said, hey, I've got an opportunity for you if you want to take it. Mm-hmm. He was a principal at a school, and I'm like, okay, no problem. He said, can you speak for 20 minutes? And I said, sure. He said, all I can pay you is $75. And I said, no problem. And then he told me it was to a group of fifth graders. And I said, I said, fifth graders? He said, yeah, it's their graduation. I think you can speak to them. I think they'll get something out of it. And my exact response was, man, I can't speak to some 10-year-olds. But then I caught myself and I said, if you're as good as you say you are, you'll find a way. So that was 2010. I spoke to these fifth graders. The speech I gave them was, I believe in me. And I gave the speech, and the guy gave me the check. And I kept that check probably for 3 months. I didn't cash it. I made a copy of it, and I put it in a frame. Because that check, to me, although it was $75, it could have been worth as much as $1 million. Because it told me what I wanted to do was possible.
Right.
I spoke, and 3 weeks later, I got this big envelope in the mail, and I figured it was a T-shirt or something from the school, mm-hmm. and I still have it to this day. There were letters in there from those fifth graders, and some of their comments, although it was fifth grade writing, uh-huh. but I read some of the comments, and I said, they got it. They understood. They got it. And it blew me away. And I still have them to this day. But it was further credence. I'm like, okay, if you can get through to these fifth graders, you can get through to anybody. Right. And so that was kind of the launching pad or the confirmation that I needed through some difficult times that I've got a skill. Now I just have to work on it and refine it and see what it can do for me.
Well, you know, this goes exactly with what you said about focusing on a solution and you know, you need to start with yourself to make a difference uh-huh. in the world. You talked to a bunch of fifth graders, and at the time you didn't know if you were doing a good job or, you know, that even if you could. And the letters that you got back showed that they not only listened to you, but you influenced them. And, you know, teachers are like this all the time. They go home, they're tired, they're frustrated, they don't know if the kids are understanding. And then years later, one of them will come back and say, you inspired me to do something. Just like somebody in that fifth grade class is going to go on, more than somebody, a bunch of somebodies is going to go on and make a huge difference in the world. And you may have been the catalyst, just like this with people now wanting to speak up or wanting to share their stories or wanting to help or wanting to register people to vote. One person can make a huge difference in history, you know? So
that's true.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else, since we're talking now about you know, being a brat, the military, what's going on in the world, is there anything that's weighing on your mind that you'd like to tell our listeners?
I don't really do negativity, but I would like everybody to understand, going back to something you asked about, what could people do? Mm-hmm. Whatever that is, ask yourself why. why is it that you want to do X, Y, or Z? Because if you know the why, the how becomes easy. If we want to make things better, the question is why. Because if we know why, we have a purpose. And if we have a purpose, we'll make a way. So that weighs heavily on my mind, because ultimately I would like my services or my words not to be needed, because people want to work together simply because there is a commonality and there's a bond that we all have that says this is what we're going to do, not because we have to, but because we want to. If we ever could get to that point where we don't have to beg and ask and have some kind of tragedy to bring us together, then miracles happen. And so my commitment for what I do, and sometimes when I post things, is to try to get us closer to a miracle.
Well,
so I don't know. That's the question. But it's,
no, that was perfect. That was really good, because you broke it down into some things that people can actually do. Determine the why, and then how come, and then finding the purpose. It's a step by step thing, and it's a personal step by step thing, because the why is going to be different for every single person. But yet it's doable, because only you can, you know, it's like taking a journey. You're the first step, you know?
Right.
Well,
that's right.
You know, Mark, this has been a really good conversation. We've talked for almost an hour.
Really?
Yeah, everybody says that. Really? Wow. 56 minutes and 42 seconds. But we needed to probably wrap it up. And so I wanted just to tell everyone out there that, I've been speaking with Mark Greer. My name is Circe, and this has been our podcast series, Colorblind. Stay tuned for more episodes in the next few weeks on our Podbean site. The museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, and Sandia Area Credit Union. And I wanted to thank you so much for this conversation today, Mark.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure. It's been all mine.
Well, thank you, thank you, thank you.